From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. When times are tough, there's a certain kind of story that comes into its own. Myths, legends, fairy tales. Stories that have stood the test of time, and then some. Stories that have been around so long they've become living repositories of wisdom. Proof that our ancestors survived worse. Reminders that no matter how bad things get, we still live in an enchanted world. That wishes really do come true, and that impossible things can happen before breakfast.
Once there were four children whose names were Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy.
Once upon a time, there was a king who didn't have any ministers.
Ram's father had four wives.
Three wives? Four sons.
There's something about these worlds that is deeply different from ordinary reality. Here is the opportunity for the child to become a hero.
Voldemort has chosen Draco Malfoy for a mission.
What does it mean, Gandalf?
But first, we've got a birthday to celebrate. It's been 100 years since Ratty, Mole, Badger, and the wicked Mr. Toad first stepped off the page and into the imagination. Like this.
The Mole had been working very hard all the morning, spring cleaning his little home. First with brooms, then with dusters, then on ladders and steps and chairs, with a brush and a pail of whitewash. Spring was moving in the air above and in the earth below and around him, penetrating even his dark and lowly little house with its spirit of divine discontent and longing.
The Wind in the Willows by Kenneth Graham was an instant bestseller when it was published, and it remains one of the most beloved children's stories of all time. It's inspired everyone from the creator of Winnie the Pooh to Pink Floyd. There's a brand new annotated version of the classic, just out, edited by Annie Gauger, one of the world's leading experts on The Wind in the Willows. She told Steve Paulson that when Kenneth Graham wrote it, he tapped into something primal.
It's sort of a return to your bucolic roots, or a wish to get back to the land. And Graham, at his time, really wanted to get back into the country, into the land. He had become a Londoner for many, many years. And I think the same with our generation at this time now. We also long for the land and a small town in England or a small riverbank, someplace close and not cluttered with traffic and noise.
Now, did this come from Kenneth Graham's own life? I mean, you said that he had spent a lot of time living in London. Did he himself spend much time out in nature?
Well, yes, of course. He was born in Scotland, in Edinburgh, and shuffled off to Cookham Dean in southern England. And there he was in this beautiful riverside town, very happy and content as a little boy. And then at the age of 8, he was then packed up and sent to Oxford to go to boarding school, which is very, very common in England and was at that time. And so if you've ever spent any time in Oxford, it's this big cake of a city, but it's little because you can walk 2 blocks and there you are in this cow pasture with a river running through it. So he really was very much surrounded by nature. He was then sent off as a young man of college age to get a post as a clerk in the Bank of England. And so he became a Londoner in the most industrial moment of being in London. He spent much of his adult life in those years, long before The Wind in the Willows, going back out into the countryside, going on walking trips, just to do anything to get out of that city.
And there's a long tradition in English literature of invoking the English landscape. I mean, there's almost a mythic quality to it, and Kenneth Graham seems to have plugged into that.
Yes, going out into the land. And of course, you have the rise of the automobile, which at that time only the very few had. But those very few who had that car just wreaked havoc on the countryside, which you see in Chapter 2, when the riverbankers get run off the road by a motor car and the horse upsets the cart and the cart is smashed. And then, of course, Mr. Toad is like, poop, poop, a car.
Oh,
Oh, isn't this gorgeous? I'm Toad the Terror, the Traffic Queller, the Lord of the Lone Trail, before whom all must give way.
So he's very much of his moment.
Now, I can't remember if it's Ratty who says that he's simply messing about in boats.
That's it, chapter one.
That's a lovely boat. Well, I like it. I've never been in a boat. I'm sorry? I thought for a moment you said you'd never been in a boat.
I haven't.
Bless my soul!
Why, is it so nice?
Nice? No, it's not nice. It's the only thing. Believe me, my young friend, there is nothing, absolutely nothing, half so much worth doing as simply messing about in boats. But nice? Ha! That's not the half of it.
And that's the water rat to the mole in the first chapter. Well, if you go down to a place in Cornwall called Foy, spelled F-O-W-E-Y, that is a place that Graham went in the year of 1899 to recover from a lung disease. And it's an absolutely astonishingly beautiful place, the way you might think the Outer Cape is. Only it's hilly and full of cows and walkways up the hills. But it's a place that is just dotted with little boats, hundreds and hundreds of them. And he made friends with a person named Arthur Quillercooch, or Q, as he was known. And they would boat every day. I mean, he'd get up and he'd run down that hill and they'd get in a boat and they'd be off and then they'd come back. And then Q just gave him one of his boats and whenever he could just go on out on that river.
So this is a river.
My dear Mo, if I may correct you, not a river, the river.
And you really live by the river? What a jolly life.
Yeah, by it and with it and on it and in it. It's my world and I don't want any other.
Doesn't it get a bit dull at times?
So there's a piece of Kenneth Graham who was Ratty, this guy who puttered about in the boat. I suppose probably also a piece who was Mole, who was more the homebody, the industrious, rather conservative fellow.
Mole is what Graham was. He was a clerk. You know, he's sort of a clerky person who's an underling who wishes to go about boating. I mean, you open the book and he's whitewashing his little underground house. And he says, oh, hang it. Off I go. And he does.
Hang whitewashing. And hang spring cleaning.
Ah, up we go. Up we go.
Oh, the light, the air, the freedom.
Where do you think you're going, young mole? You can't come through this meadow.
Now, how did Kenneth Graham come to write this story? Because it's actually a huge departure from the previous books that he had written and published, and which were big hits, and this was something totally different.
Well, he had no desire to write. He hated writing, actually. It was torture for him. And along comes this woman, an American, by the name of Constance Smedley. Her editor, Cosgrave, from Everybody's Magazine, says, go get Kenneth Graham to write anything at any price. So she goes to visit Graham. She realizes that Graham's real story right now is this set of tales that he's been worked up with Alistair. He and Alistair have had this exchange.
Alistair
going
being
on.
His young son.
His son, Alistair Graham and Kenneth Graham have had this rapport they've worked up of storytelling, and it's gone on for years, because you have to remember that Alistair is blind. He doesn't read necessarily well. So she says, well, there's your story. Why don't you write that up into a book? And Alistair, of course, was, yes, Daddy, please do. And so, of course, he did. And Miss Smedley took it to Cosgrave, and he, of course, rejected it flat. And then Scribner's son in America rejected it and said, oh, we've seen enough of these animal stories. Ick.
There's a remarkable story about how the book came to be published, because various publishers had seen the manuscript, or at least a few chapters, didn't like
yeah,
it. And then Scribner's actually got a letter from the President of the United States, Teddy Roosevelt, who
oh,
had
yes.
been sent a manuscript, and he loved the book, and he urged Scribner's to publish it.
Well, and this is part of the story, is that Roosevelt didn't like it himself. He didn't care for it a bit until his children and his wife got behind it. And then he was like, oh, well, I see what we're getting at here. Of course, this is marvelous. We must have it. And then he writes off to Charles Scribner, who is his friend and confidant, and Scribner publishes it.
Now, this book was very much the product of the relationship between Kenneth Graham and his young son, Alistair. I mean, Graham had read the stories or told the stories for years. Apparently, Alistair would ask questions, and it was kind of the product of what the two of them had together. But Alistair's own life ended rather tragically, didn't it?
It did end tragically. He was considered an enfant terrible, but you have to realize he was born handicapped, and he had very limited sight. But he was really kind of stuffed into that English public school system. And then he's sent up to Oxford, and he just can't quite pass his exams, and it doesn't work for him. So he went out one night. He dined in Hall at Christ Church. That was his college, which is one of the most posh colleges in Oxford. And he gets a bottle of port, and he goes out to Port Meadow, where the train tracks are, and he lays down on the train tracks and commits suicide. And this is just a few days shy of his 20th birthday.
It must have been just devastating to Kenneth.
Devastating. I mean, there's a letter, set of letters between Quillercouch and Graham about the death and the loss of this boy and the grief. And after that time, Graham pretty much typed every letter that he wrote. He had the most beautiful handwriting, and his hand began to shake at this time. He developed tremor. So that's pretty much the story of the end of Alistair.
Did Kenneth Graham come to see The Wind in the Willows as his great achievement?
Well, I don't think that he was a person who saw things as achievements, really. There's an account of him in Pangbourne, which is the last place that he lived. He lived in a place called Church Cottage. Pangbourne's a riverside town. And there's a couple of accounts of him about the children of the town saying, oh, we call him the sugar man because he's so sweet. And he, you know, he was like gruff Mr. Badger. He wasn't interested in other people's children. You know, and he said to these children, well, I'm off to see the pretty little boats. And he just turned and walked away down to the riverbank to see the pretty little boats.
Listen, if you've nothing else on this morning, what say we drop down the river together and make a day of it?
What, in the boat? Together? Could we? Could we really?
Certainly. Hop in.
Oh.
That's it. Careful. Oh. That's the idea. Now, first item on the agenda, a spot of provender. Put this hamper on your lap.
What's in it?
There's cold chicken in it, cold ham, cold tongue, cold beef, pickled gherkins, sausage rolls, cress sandwiches, ginger beer, lemonade.
Oh, stop, stop. This is too much.
Do you really think so? It's only what I always take. The other animals are always saying I'm a mean beast and cut it very fine. Comfy?
Rather.
Right. Off we go. I've never told anyone this before, Mo, but I'm a bit of a poet.
Well, I shouldn't worry about it. It's probably just a stage. I once had a shot at the trombone.
That's from Alan Bennett's BBC radio adaptation of The Wind in the Willows. And we heard Annie Gauger talking with Steve Paulson about her new annotated edition of the classic. You'll find more information about both on our website at ttbook.org. And now,
Rama's great, Rama's good, Rama does what Rama should. Rama's just, Rama's right, Rama is our guiding light.
The ancient Hindu story of the god Rama and his lovely wife Sita hardly seems like material for an animated cartoon. But in the hands of syndicated comic strip artist and now filmmaker Nina Paley, it's taken on a whole new life. Sita Sings the Blues is a film Paley made based on her reading of the 3,000-year-old Sanskrit epic, the Ramayana. It's a highly personal and eclectic retelling, including cartoon animation, Indonesian shadow puppets, the voice of a 20s-era jazz singer, and the story of Paley's own tortured marriage, which she says was not unlike Rama and Sita's.
I had been reading the Ramayana, and then while I was reading different Ramayanas, my husband dumped me by email while I was on a business trip to New York. And this is before better dumpings had made the news, such as text message dumpings. This was rather groundbreaking at the time.
Yeah. How did that turn into Sita Sings the Blues?
It was a very difficult event for me to accept in my own life, and there was no real way for me to run away from it or explain it. And I was really struck from even my first reading of the Ramayana, I couldn't understand why Sita behaved the way she did and why Ram behaved the way he did. And in fact, I still don't completely understand why they behaved the way that they do. I mean, logically, it doesn't really make sense. But then the way I and my ex were behaving doesn't make logical sense either. I think, you know, reading this story that's thousands of years old and has been retold billions of times just made me feel connected to the human race. It made me realize, oh, what happened to me is not an isolated thing. This has been going on forever. This is a really primal, basic human experience. And, you know, Valmiki was writing about it, you know, in 500 BC.
Make Sita your wife, Ravana. Steal her from Rama.
Don't do it, Master.
I'll hear no arguments from you, Maricha. You must help me at once. Transform yourself into a beautiful golden deer to distract Rama. While Sita is unguarded, I'll grab her. Sita will be mine.
One of the things I love about your movie, frankly, is the singing of Annette Henshaw. I confess I'd never heard of her before, but boy, after this, I think anybody who's heard her sing is going to want to go find more. Where did you learn about her?
Well, that same couple weeks when I was in New York City on my business trip, my husband had just dumped me by email. I'd been reading Ramayanas. I was sleeping on the sofas of friends, and one of them was a record collector, Sherwin Dunner, actually. And he had Annette Henshaw in his collection. And I was hooked. And to me, it sounded, I just connected with it immediately, the same way I was connecting to the Ramayana at that point.
This is the sound of your emotion.
Yes, it is. And there's something so special about Annette Henshaw's voice. You know, the more I read about Sita, like, I didn't understand Sita. Like, why was she so nice? Why was she so pure? Why didn't she, like, ever just get mad at Rama or yell or do something violent or angry? And she never did. And I heard that quality in Annette Henshaw's voice, that even when she was singing these Man Done Me Wrong songs, it was with this sweet little voice.
You're mean to me. Why must you be mean to me? Gee, honey, it seems to me you love to see me crying. I don't know why I stay home each night when you say you'll phone. You don't, and I'm left alone, singing the blues and sighing.
Tell me about the film. This is what you call 2D animation, isn't it?
Yes, it's two-dimensional as opposed to that newfangled 3D stuff.
But there's all sorts of stuff going on. Some of it looks as though it was painted on paper. The city scenes, San Francisco and New York, look like you used photographs in the background. Some of it is stick figures. Some of it is... You used a lot of different sources.
Yes, and a lot of different styles. There's, I think, four main categories of visual style in Sita Sings the Blues. And each one has its own kind of sound that's associated with it. So the scenes in which Annette Henshaw is singing, those are a really cartoony kind of Fleischer, Betty Boopy influenced. I made some fake Mogul miniature paintings myself, where I painted using old watercolors on parchment paper. And then there's the unscripted part, where there's three friends of mine who had gone to a recording studio here in New York, and they just spoke. They just answered questions about the Ramayana and had these hilarious conversations with each other.
You want to know the whole story? Oh, because Ram's father had four wives.
Three wives?
Four sons.
Four sons, three wives. Okay, I know the names of the sons, by the way.
Kausalya.
Yeah. No,
that was the wife. Yeah. That's what I meant.
So, but
Kausalya, Sumitra, and Kaikeyi. And Kausalya's son was Ram. Sumitra's son was Lakshman. Sita was Ram's wife.
Right.
Sita has many names. Sita only being one of them.
Yeah. Janaki also.
I'm representing the RSS.
And I saw a Vedahi. I saw a play called Vedahi, right, which I learned there was another name for Sita.
This was also clearly a very personal thing for you to do. In fact, there is in the movie one scene that's sort of brutally personal. Your stick figure, Nina, is calling your husband and begging him to come back to you. Sita sort of does the same thing. That has to have been difficult to do, wasn't it?
It was more difficult to live. You know, once I lived through it, it wasn't really as hard to recreate. I mean, I thought about this a lot. Yeah, I was really perplexed by my own behavior. That's another reason I was so fascinated by the Ramayana, because first when I read it, I was like, I don't understand Sita's behavior. And then it's like, I don't understand my own behavior at all. But I did that.
Do you feel closer to Sita after that?
I do, but of course I can only feel close to my conception of Sita, my understanding of Sita. Everyone is going to have their own, like, inner Sita, and I'm a lot closer to mine.
Hello?
Please take me back! Please, please, please! I'll do anything, please!
You have lived in another man's house, so you are unfit to be my wife.
What?
I have done my duty in rescuing you from the enemy and avenging the insult to myself. I have terrible suspicions about your character and conduct. Ravana was aware of your beauty. He cannot have kept you in his house for so long without touching you. The very sight of you is painful. You are free to go wherever you want. I have no more use for you, Sita.
If I had known this, I would have killed myself before and spared you this war. Build me a funeral pyre. I cannot bear to live. Despite my virtues, my husband has rejected me.
Has anybody argued that you shouldn't have done this? I mean, you are, after all, a white American woman. You are not raised Hindi. You were here reinterpreting a Hindu epic. I imagine some people would say the Ramayana is not yours to play with this way.
Yes, there was much of that. And of course, even I was concerned about doing it. Like, I thought a lot before I even started. Like, can I do this? Am I allowed to do this? But there was nothing else I could think of doing that made me want to actually live. I was so compelled towards doing this.
One of the things that must have been of some value to you is discovering the value of myth. I mean, you said that this was in part done because it was therapeutic for you. It was something you felt you had to, a story you had to tell because of the breakup. But looking at a story that has lasted for thousands of years, I suppose you began to look in it for ways to find your way into the future from that past.
Absolutely. It's a story that's really withstood the test of time. I mean, stories that are meaningless don't last for thousands of years, and they're not told by billions of people. So the very fact that it is such a culturally important story made me pay attention to it and made me sort of ask it for answers. The introduction to many Ramayanas talks about the blessings that are conferred upon the teller of the Ramayana, or the reader. And by reader, it could also mean reading aloud. You know, whoever reads the Ramayana will be blessed this way and that way. And it's true. Like, if you read it, if you share it, something happens to you.
Nina Paley is the creator of the film Sita Sings the Blues, a retelling of the ancient Sanskrit epic poem, the Ramayana.
Rama's great, Rama's good, Rama does what Rama should, Rama's just, Rama's right, Rama is our guiding light, perfect man, perfect son, Rama's loved by everyone,
always right, never wrong, we praise Rama in this song, sing his love.
Still to come, more tales of magic and sorcery, brave children, and talking animals. And Christopher Walken reads Goodnight Moon? Well, we'll find out. Supporters of To the Best of Our Knowledge include the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.
over, Harry Potter. 1,000 years ago or more, storytellers traveled the trade routes of the Middle East and Central Asia, telling tales of the legendary hero Amir Hamza and his magical battles with evil sorcerers and wizards. The stories made their way to India, where they became part of a storytelling tradition that lasted for hundreds of years, until it was forgotten. Now a group of young Indian scholars and storytellers is trying to revive the lost tradition with performances like these.
Amir Hamza, ki jab hairat ko pata chala ki khunkhar jadu bhi ayyaron ke haath mara gaya, to hairat ne khat is tamam.
The legends of Amir Hamza were written in Urdu. They're being translated into English for the first time by Musharraf Ali Farooqi. Recently, he's been working on a collection of stories called Hushruba. Farooqi told Anne Strangechamps it is the first and longest magical fantasy ever written.
Hushruba itself means something which completely captures your senses and overwhelms the senses. From Hosh, senses, and Ruba means something that it steals. But Hushruba, as we experience in this fantasy epic, is both a land and a talism. Now, the talism is an artificial world created by sorcerers, and they have created this talism on the land called Hushruba. And that talism is separate from the land, because when you enter the talism, all the known applicable physical laws as we see them, as we experience them in the world, are turned upside down or completely manipulatable by the sorcerer, and he can completely mold them according to his calculations, according to his wishes.
So in the Islamic tradition, these sorcerers basically can create parallel universes that live side by side or almost on top of the original universe?
That's correct.
And then magical, wondrous things happen inside these parallel universes?
But of course. That's the whole purpose in creating them. But this was the first time that an entire universe, parallel universe, was created by a group of sorcerers. Now, an usurper called Afrasiab, the emperor of sorcerers, he takes over that world and decides to defend it. So that causes the conflict.
There's a story behind the story, right? The story of how the Hushruba, this story cycle, was created in the mm-hmm. first place. It began, in a way, as a kind of storytelling hoax.
That's right. And the storytellers whose bread and butter was the story of Amir Hamza, who was a fictitious character, they would recite tales of his bravery, tales of his adventures. But when in late 18th century, early 19th century, a new group of storytellers took over that old myth of Amir Hamza, they decided that they could do much more with it. So they kept the character of Amir Hamza in the story, but he becomes more and more irrelevant as the story progresses, because the story is really about the tricksters and their fights with the sorcerers and the sorceresses.
Do you have one or two favorite characters?
Yes, there is one character. She is a sorceress princess. Her name is Princess Bahar of Spring Quarter, because wherever she goes, or whenever, her magic is to create the atmosphere of spring. And that enchants anybody who comes to fight her. And of course, then there's the Emperor of Sorcerers. So these two are my favorite characters. And if you wish, I can read you a short passage in a fight where Princess Bahar of Spring Quarter is fighting a sorcerer called Rutas, who has a special magic that turns people into trees. And then she responds to his magic. Rutas recited a spell and clapped. Suddenly, thousands upon thousands of magic birds came flying from the direction of the wilderness and began perching on the heads of Mahrukh's soldiers. Whenever a magic bird landed on someone's head, he immediately turned into a tree. Shoots sprouted from his body, green leaves covered him, and birds made their nests in them.
Bahar descended from her throne. She undid her hair, took out a small box and opened its lid. Inside was a small, beautifully carved ivory figurine. Bahar cut her finger and let fall a few drops of blood onto the ivory figurine and said, "O magic slave girl, regard the magic birds that perch on my men and turn them into trees." The magic slave girl laughed, leapt out of the box and disappeared. A few moments later, everyone noticed a net spread over the length and breadth of the sky. They saw flocks of rootless magic birds struggling inside the net. The magic slave girl, with a knife in her hand, brought the birds out from the net and slaughtered them. Their blood splashed on the trees and returned them to human form.
That's wonderful. Such powerful images, you know, the figurine of ivory that becomes the magical slave girl. One thing I noticed right away is that the female characters are very powerful.
They are, and this is a function of, again, from the society which in which this story developed. Women, although they are not seen these days in the forefront of our social life in Pakistan and India, although it's changing, they had a much more vibrant social life in the early 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. There were women kings and women princesses in India who held power for very long periods of time. One of the critics does say that basically Hoshruba is a power document for women because they, even men, are only successful when they dress up as women and kill the sorcerers. So this was one of the things that one of the very early critics said.
Now, as a translator, you've taken on your own epic hero's quest, translating the Hoshruba, which is 8,000 pages long. That sounds like a very foundational text. Why hasn't it been translated before?
I have a couple of theories. They could be completely wrong, but I think that when Hoshruba was first compiled in a text form, the colonial engagement with India was on its ebb. So translating literary texts was not one of their priorities at that point in the colonial experience. And these foundational texts, their language became so inaccessible over the years because no modern editions were published, that it became increasingly difficult to translate them. For example, this whole thing is unpunctuated text in Urdu. And in Urdu, it's 8,000 pages, but Urdu expands when translated. So in English, it would be close to 11 or 12,000 pages.
How long is it going to take you to translate this?
8 to 10 years only.
You're very fast.
Yes. I always tell people that, look, by the time I'm 50, I would have done it. And everyone knows that life begins at 50. So I'll be fine.
I'm thinking of how many children would adore this. All those children who've waited with bated breath for every subsequent Harry Potter book and who are simply sad that that particular universe is over. The prospect of an 11,000-page fantastical universe
will keep them occupied for a very long time.
Yes.
Musharraf Ali Faruqi is the translator of The Adventures of Amir Hamza and, most recently, Hoshruba. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him. Ever wonder why the stories we remember best are often those we heard first? Snow White, Hansel and Gretel, Charlotte's Web, Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, The Magical Land Inside the Wardrobe, or at platform 9 3/4. Few people understand the power of children's stories quite as well as Maria Tatar. The Harvard Scholar of Children's Literature has edited annotated editions of The Grimm's Fairy Tales and Hans Christian Andersen's Tales. In a new book called Enchanted Hunters, she explores the power of words to create other worlds. Steve Paulson asked her, what's the most impressionable age for reading?
Probably the most exciting years are those up until about age 14, when you are making these voyages of discovery and seeing these new worlds and finding out that there are things like Turkish delight or glass elevators, things that you don't see in real life often.
So which books made the biggest impression on you?
I think that it started with fairy tales for me. My sister read them to me, And I can still see in my mind's eye the picture of Snow White's glass coffin and the dwarfs surrounding it. Also, Little Red Riding Hood, of course, everyone's first love in many ways.
What's interesting about those examples you just mentioned is there's something pretty scary in them, sometimes even kind of horrifying. I mean, Snow White, she is in the glass coffin. Seems like she's died. Little Red Riding Hood, you know, she's going off to
and
meet this carnivorous wolf. Yes.
Right. In the French version, there is no hunter that comes along to rescue her. She's swallowed by the wolf, and that's the end of the story. I remember reading Michael Strogoff as a child and just being horrified. The hero comes across, a head buried in, the body's buried in the sand, but it's just a head. And I remember being fascinated by that and horrified by the thought that that could happen to you. There are stories like the juniper tree, which give us a stepmother who slams the lid of a chest down on a little boy's head, decapitating him. She then chops him up and puts him into a stew that is served to the boy's father. So this is really mythical and primal. And I think it helps children in some ways work through their anxieties about bodily integrity. What happens if? And that tale ends happily when the boy is brought back to life.
One thing that I find striking is a lot of the most popular children's books of, let's say, the last decade or so are fantasy. I mean, Harry Potter being the obvious example, but we could talk about other series by Philip Pullman or Tamara Pierce or Christopher Paolini. Is there something in particular about fantasy that makes a lasting impression?
I think it's the authors of fantasy literature create these other worlds with just extraordinary detail. They create a whole world. And if you think of the Harry Potter series, they're now encyclopedias and websites which help you navigate through that symbolic world. Children love to talk about those little objects, those tiny objects embedded in these stories. In Philip Pullman's His Dark Materials trilogy, you have Lyra, a heroine who is undertaking really the reinvention of mankind. She is a sort of redeemer figure and a new Eve. So there is a story that really allows children to undertake a journey that is fraught with peril, that requires courage, cleverness on the part of the heroine.
It seems like a couple of things are going on, at least in those two series that you were just talking about. One is an entirely alternate universe is created with all kinds of details, which requires a lot of creative imagination. And then also, in this fantasy world, there is, I suppose, more latitude given to the young hero to make his or her way, to transform the world.
Absolutely. It's a parallel universe. And what is so fascinating about it for children, I think, is that there's magic in it. You know, there are things that Lyra can do. Lyra has this wonderful alethiometer that she can read. Harry Potter, of course, goes to Hogwarts and learns wizardry. So there's something about these worlds that is deeply different from ordinary reality. Also, of course, here's the opportunity for the child to become a hero, which so rarely happens in real life. That is, children in fantasy have a kind of agency that they clearly don't have in our ordinary world.
Let me ask you about a classic picture book, Goodnight Moon, which I used to read all the time to my kids. And at one level, it's a very comforting book. I mean, it's very easy to read aloud and to read over and over again, which is one of the hallmarks of a good picture book. But it's not altogether comforting, I don't think. I mean, again, the parents are absent, and there's this kind of strange woman in there.
In the room. And then that last line, good night noises everywhere. And the hands of the clock have moved. It's become dark, and the bunny has lost consciousness, which is a scary moment for children. This is one of the reasons why reading them to sleep is such a great idea, because you're providing comfort in the night. There's a wonderful Simpsons episode with Christopher Walken, reading Goodnight Moon to a group of terrified toddlers. They're sort of inching away from him. So it sort of captures the fact that this is not... Actually, it's a comforting story, but it takes on one of the great existential mysteries for the toddler.
Being what?
Death. You know, what happens to you when you fall asleep, when your eyes close? Will you wake up the next morning? I'm sure you know the prayer, if I should die before I wake. What a scary line for children to have to say at night.
Oh, I've never really thought of Goodnight Moon as dealing with that existential issue.
It's a very deep book. It's definitely one of the deepest books for toddlers.
Hmm. You say that maybe the writer who understood the experience of reading better than anyone else was Marcel Proust, which is sort of an interesting observation. What was it about Proust that was so perceptive?
Proust saw reading not as an escape from reality, but as a way of opening up a whole new reality. That is, for him, there's something about books and writing that was actually superior to reality. So I think he was so in touch with the beauty of what can be created by words, and also with how those words stimulate our curiosity. That is, writers don't give us answers, but what they do is that they lead us to ask new questions, to move from one book to the next, and keep reading and keep making discoveries as we read.
Maria Tatar, talking with Steve Paulson about her new book, Enchanted Hunters, The Power of Stories in Childhood. And because we know you wanted to hear just how horrifying Goodnight Moon can be.
Look, Maggie, Christopher Walken's reading Goodnight Moon.
Goodnight, room. Goodnight, moon. Goodnight, cow jumping over the moon. Please, children, scooch closer. Don't make me tell you again about the scooching. You and the red, chop, chop.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. So, here's a fairy tale you might not want to read to a child before bed. Once upon a time, there was a good man who was happy about his life. Then a mosquito flew by and landed on his hand to suck some of his blood. When the good man saw the mosquito, he knew that it wanted to suck his blood, and he thought, "The poor little mosquito should suck my blood until it's full," and he didn't disturb it. Then the mosquito stung the man, sucked his blood until it was content, and flew away, totally grateful. It was so happy that it told all the mosquitoes how good the man had been and how good his blood had tasted. Then the sky became black with mosquitoes, and they all wanted to see the good man and suck his good blood. And they stung and stung and sucked, and none of them became full, because there were too many of them. Meanwhile, the good man died. That's the story of the good man, written by German Dadaist artist Kurt Schwitters. He was one of the most celebrated modern artists in Europe in the 20s and 30s, until his career was cut short by the Nazis. Schwitters was a painter and a poet, who wrote satirical, surrealist fairy tales. A collection of them called Lucky Hans has just been translated and edited by Jack Zipes, one of the world's leading experts on fairy tales. Zipes told Enchantchamps that Kurt Schwitters wasn't the only European artist to experiment with fairy tales.
The experimentation was generally done by people left of center. And the reason they were doing that was because they felt that the Grimm's fairy tales and the traditional folk tales and Andersen's fairy tales were ultra-conservative and As you know, after 1919, there were revolutions all over Europe, and it was a great revolutionary period of the arts. And so, of course, many writers thought, well, if we're going to change attitudes and dispositions and ideas, we definitely must change fairy tales.
What would be conservative about, say, Little Red Riding Hood?
Oh, we might talk for several hours about Little Red Riding Hood. Little Red Riding Hood is a tale about rape. It's a tale about rape in which the young girl is generally made guilty for bringing about the violation of her grandmother and her own violation. Almost all the Grimm's fairy tales are sexist. If you reread them, and also Andersen's tales are very sexist and to a certain extent racist and so on and so forth. These classical fairy tales were very entrenched in European cultures, and a lot of these writers began reviewing them very carefully and wanted to produce something new. So it's not by chance that writers turn to fairy tales.
Well, when you read Schwitter's fairy tales, it's not just that he's writing a feminist version of Little Red Riding Hood. He's taken elements and bits and pieces that we recognize from fairy tales and created something completely topsy-turvy, a weird sort of absurdist kind of world.
Yes, definitely. He takes recognizable motifs and characters, plots, and he turns them upside down so that you expose the ridiculous nature of many of the rules and regulations that we have arbitrarily constructed to run our lives. So Schwitters wanted to question all of that.
A lot of these fairy tales are very short. Is there one you could read for us?
Oh, sure. I would be pleased to. I'll read a tale that I think is really points out the absurdist nature of society. It's called A King Without People. Once upon a time, there was a king who didn't have any ministers. He didn't have any peasants. He didn't have any courtiers. He had no one whatsoever. This king expected an envoy from the neighboring people who didn't have a king, because these people had a successor to the throne who didn't have a wife, and he wanted to fill this present gap by courting the king's daughter. However, the envoy didn't come, and therefore the king held the following speech. Gentlemen, ambassadors of my royal neighbor, I am pleased that you haven't come to court my daughter, for I don't have any daughters whatsoever. Tell your chief that I am going to give his royal highness my entire love, my child, and half of my possessions. Since he didn't have any possessions at all, however, it didn't make much of a difference if he gave away half. The other half would be sufficient for his old age.
Okay, that's a fairy tale that's a little hard to follow, because every time you think there's something real that's there, there's nothing.
Right.
Is this Kurt Schwitter's take on the emperor who has no clothes?
Exactly, or just a mock fairy tale about kings and queens and the whole notion of the monarchy. And it's through that ridicule, you know, that he wants to do away with these set of fixed notions about life.
Hmm. You could call them anti-fairy tales in a way, couldn't you? Because I was thinking, you've written that one of the main purposes of fairy tales is to offer hope in some way, some
yes.
vision of a
right.
world in which there is hope. And that tale in particular seems to offer exactly the opposite, the idea that there's no hope at all.
I think that there is a way that one can look at Schwitter's fairy tales as being fairy tales of hope, not in the traditional sort of utopian sense of hope. For instance, a lot of his fairy tales are about happiness and why people don't ever become happy and why we can never find happiness. But if we do away with these illusions, I think that Schwitters believed there was more hope in our lives than we realized, and that the first step toward having hope is by confronting our realities, by exposing what is ridiculous, absurd, bizarre, odd, and so on, and creating almost like a level playing field where people can almost democratically, if you will, decide what the truth is and how we can create a different type of community.
Schwitters had an unhappy time under the Nazis. He was one of those writers whose books were burned. He himself was denounced as degenerate. He wound up having to flee Nazi Germany with his son.
Ernst, right.
And never saw Germany again, did he?
No, he never did. Ernst, their son, was a rabid anti-fascist and refused to join the Hitler Youth Organization, and so his life was in danger. And the family had quite often vacationed in Norway, and they had friends in Norway. So Ernst left Hanover and fled the Nazis and went to Norway, followed soon after by Kurt Schwitters. In the meantime, Helga Fischer, his wife, remained behind because her parents were still alive and his parents were still alive. So she was looking after both sets of parents and the house. But when the Nazis invaded Norway in 1940, Schwitters once again with his son, they both had to flee for their lives. So in 1940, they made their way on a perilous journey using Fischer boats to England. And his wife, Helga, contracted cancer and died in 1944. And she stayed also in the house, which was bombed, by the way, in 1944. And a good many of Schwitter's artworks were destroyed in the bombing of Hanover.
I can't help but think that his life sounds a bit like one of his fairy tales. You know, there's certainly no one they lived happily ever after.
No, well, it was sad. He led a sad life because in the 1920s, his work was exhibited throughout the world. And he was also known for being an amazing performance artist. He traveled widely throughout Europe during the 1920s until 1933 when the Nazis came to power.
Jack Zipes talking about his new edition of fairy tales by Kurt Schwitters. It's called Lucky Hans. And as you can imagine, Hans is not very lucky at all. And Strange Champ spoke with him. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Got a comment or question about today's show? Send an email to our website, where you will also find book and music listings and a link to our weekly podcast. It's at ttbook.org. Or visit our Facebook page and become a fan. If you want a copy of today's shows, you can buy one from the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for The Fairy Tale Hour, number 628A. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. And Strange Champs put this hour together with help from Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, Mary Lou Finnegan, Veronica Rickert, and Claire Radomski. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Kirill Owen is our wizard, better known as technical director. We also had help today from Kashika Singh and from the Asia Society. Supporters of To the Best of Our Knowledge include the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.